tape has brightening arm connect.
Welcome to the better weather for Friday, September 26th. Local early morning temperatures range from 58 degrees in Medusa.
The Catskill Food Pantry is located in the Parish Hall of St. Luke's Episcopal Church at 50 William Street in Catskill.
Today will be good.
The pantry is open to the public every Friday from 1 to 4 p.m.
Warm. We see a high of
healthy
79
food is
at
right.
4 p.m.
For more information, please feel welcome to visit the pantry.
Overnight,
call us at 551-299-2456. Check the website at CatskillFoodPantry.org or connect with us on Facebook at Catskill Food Pantry.
La despensa de alimentos de Catskill está localizada en la parroquia de la Iglesia de St. Luke en Catskill. En la calle William, número 50. La despensa está abierta todos los viernes de la 1 hasta las 4 de la tarde. La comida sana es un derecho. Para más información, bienvenidos a todos a venir, llamar por teléfono a 551-299-2456. Mirar la página web catskillfoodpantry.org o conectar con nosotros en Facebook.
Hi everyone, it's Lily, the Youth Peer Leader from Mental Health Association of Columbia Green County. Are you a teen wanting to learn more about health education? Maybe you're looking to complete your volunteer hours or in need of a job. The weekly teen clinic on Wednesdays from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Family Planning, located on the third floor of the county building on Main Street in Catskill, can help you answer any of your questions. Information can be...
And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
The Public News Service Friday Afternoon Update, I'm Mike Clifford. President Trump's latest tariffs sent shockwaves throughout Asia, heaping additional turmoil on companies already grappling with uncertainty while adding further complexity for trade officials ironing out the details of recently struck trade agreements. That's the take from the New York Times. They report on Thursday Trump announced another round of tariffs, which would go into effect on October 1, applying import duties ranging from 25% to 100% on pharmaceuticals, heavy trucks, kitchen cabinets, bathroom vanities, and upholstered furniture. The Times notes a significant portion of furniture and kitchen cabinet manufacturing originates from China and Southeast Asia. Meantime, clean energy projects in New York and nationwide face delays, and new analysis blames the federal permitting process.
It says some projects are held up for more than a decade, not including the time it takes to address challenges like lawsuits. In 2023, the Fiscal Responsibility Act became law, creating a two-year deadline for environmental impact statements. It made modest changes, says Zan Fishman with the Bipartisan Policy Center's energy program, but the delays still have major consequences.
One consequence the projects end up costing a lot more. And when energy projects cost a lot more to build, those costs get passed to people that use the energy, the consumers, everyday Americans.
New York already has some of the highest energy costs in the nation. Fishman notes more clean energy projects are being permitted now, but there are other reasons for delays. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Now to the Gulf Coast, where a new report is sounding the alarm after volunteers found more than 1,200 plastic pellets polluting beaches in Pascagoula, Goshie, and Ocean Springs.
The lentil-sized pellets are the raw materials used to make plastic products, and the report says they're often spilled. Lisa Frank with Environment America says when they wash up on shores at places like Front Beach or Shepherd State Park, they pose a direct threat to wildlife.
They look just like fish eggs, which for lots of critters is a nutritious and delicious snack, but instead they wind up getting a belly full of plastic.
Research shows plastic pollution also fuels climate change. Darker pellets absorb more sunlight, and when mixed with snow and ice, they can lead to quicker snowmelt. Frank says citizen scientists are helping to document the extent of the problem so lawmakers can work to hold companies accountable. I'm Tremel Gomes.
And this Saturday is National Public Lands Day, meaning all national parks, forests, and other public lands in Washington State and across the country offer free admission. As public lands continue to face threats under the Trump administration, Devin O'Day of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers says celebrating victories is especially important.
We were able to defend against a large-scale sell-off of 2 to 3 million acres of public lands. Public lands are our shared inheritance. They're something that everyone in America owns and that everyone has a right to access.
Trump administration moves impacting public lands include increased resource extraction, funding cuts, and workforce reductions. This is Public News Service. Nurses and other health professionals at Kaiser Permanente facilities in Oregon and Southwest Washington have voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike.
Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals represents nearly 4,000 healthcare workers, including nurses, lab professionals, and therapists. Union President Serena Rohr says their working conditions are their patients' healing conditions, and the union is fighting for both to be the best they can be.
And that means you have to pay people well. That means you have to have safe working environments. That means you have to listen to the people who actually know how to care for the patients.
A strike could begin any time after September 30th. Rohr says the bargaining team is meeting with Kaiser as much as possible and hopes to reach a deal before then. In a statement, Kaiser, which is one of the nation's largest nonprofit healthcare providers, called the strike authorization disappointing. They added that Kaiser facilities meet and often exceed legal nurse-to-patient ratios. I'm Isabel Charlet.
We head next to Iowa, where advocates for healthy farming practices are pushing back on a federal move to give pesticide companies immunity from products that may cause cancer.
Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement sent a letter signed by more than 400 Iowans to Washington lawmakers, calling on them to oppose the so-called Cancer Gag Act, which would allow makers of glyphosate-based chemicals to sidestep immunity if it is determined they cause cancer. Ava Allen Ryan, CCI's Farm and Environment Organizing Director, calls this a common sense issue. She says the fact that this is even a debate leaves Iowans wondering who lawmakers are actually representing.
So are they working for Iowans and their constituents, or are they working for multinational chemical manufacturers like Bayer?
The Environmental Protection Agency says glyphosate poses no risks to human health when used in accordance with its current label. I'm Mark Moran.
Finally, you may be surprised to know Massachusetts is home to some of the most speech-restrictive campuses in the country. That's according to a new report.
The sixth annual College Free Speech Rankings gives some of the state's top schools, including Harvard and Boston University, a failing grade in free speech. Sean Stevens with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE, says conservative students are increasingly joining their liberal peers in supporting censorship.
We're siloing ourselves, and it's not just at the college level. We're siloing ourselves society-wide in these kind of political camps.
The rankings are based on nearly 70,000 student surveys and analysis of their school's policies and handling of campus events. Stevens says they show a deep unwillingness among students to encounter controversial ideas, with a record number of students saying it's okay to shout down a speaker or even use violence to prevent a campus speech. I'm Catherine Carley.
This is by Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And hello, you are listening to WGXC 90.7 ACRA. And you might have just heard a little something over the news, and that might have been a little technical issue. I want to reach out and thank my friend Deb for texting me and alerting me that was happening. Thank you, Deb. I'll talk to you later. This is the Friday afternoon show with your host, Simone Stevens. I am Simone, and I'm so excited today to have Philip Roebuck in the studio, the incredible, wonderful musician that I am a huge fan of as a musician and as a person.
Thank you.
And I'm just so excited that you're here. How's it going?
Great. little dodgy start there.
But. Yeah. But you know what? It was authentic. It was real, and it was, and that's a part of live radio. But so there you have it. So Phil, I first saw you play years ago. 20 years ago on the subway. There's a big exhale there, as we all do when we think about the passage of time. And it was on the subway in New York City. Also various venues. You were busy, mm-hmm. busy. And at that time, you were playing guitar. You would also play banjo. And then you had a huge kit strapped to your back.
Right.
Right. What was that? What was that whole contraption? This is before people were like looping all the time with.
Yes.
Right.
That's right.
Can you tell me a little about what your setup
it's
and
like analog looping, basically? Well, it started actually back in the 90s, really, when I still had a band back then. You know, and I made. We used to like to play. You know, do busking, you know, play in the subway or play on the street or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I made this little drum kit for our drummer, which was a suitcase. Mm-hmm. And you open up the suitcase, and then the kick pedal would come out. You'd have a little drum that kind of bolted on top, you know. and then the suitcase itself became the kick drum. Yeah. You know? And it was this cool little portable kit. And we never wound up using it. Mm-hmm. And then in 2000, I had started playing banjo like all the time. I was obsessed with it, and I was playing in the subways a lot. But my apartment had hardwood floors. Mm-hmm. And I loved when I played the banjo, you know, and you're stomping your foot, and it just, you know, it's part of that music. Is
yeah.
The foot stomp. You know?
Yeah.
And so going in the subway or whatever, playing on concrete, I just missed it, missed that sound, felt empty, you know. And so
yeah.
I started a series of experiments. I remember the first thing I brought was just a cigar box, and I just uh-huh. stomped on it, and it lasted all of a song or two until
yeah.
it crushed.
Yeah.
But then I remembered the suitcase drum kit thing.
Yeah.
So I was like, wait a second, I could play that on the bottom half.
Yeah.
You know. And then play banjo on top, and sure enough, worked like a charm right out of the gate.
Yeah.
I had like one little rehearsal in my backyard in Brooklyn, and I was out the door.
And better than you destroy tons of cigar boxes, I feel, right?
Yeah. And so I did that for a couple years. That was like my suitcase rig. And And then it was later that I got this really cool bass drum in Barcelona, actually, in Spain. And it was like this tiny, it's not tiny, I mean, it's, you know, but it's small for a kick drum and light.
Yeah.
But really had a really good deep sound. And so I started playing, I built this little backpack rig, again, just kind of like all in one afternoon, just kind of, you know, sketched it out, went and got the parts at the hardware store and put it all together, and it worked right away. And same thing. I went immediately out into the subway, you know, and started playing. And that backpack rig, I mean, I wound up playing the backpack rig, like, I don't know, 15 years.
Wow.
15 years or so.
Wow. After
that. Yeah.
Wow.
Made records with it, toured with it, you know.
Wow. And we were talking earlier about, like, that was your one-man band, right, when you started playing solo.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, you had a band. And you were, so can you talk a little bit about that project?
Right.
Yeah. And even, like, what happened, what made you, if you don't mind me asking, decide, I know why, I've known other musicians in bands, like, all of a sudden taking a solo turn.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I know for, I mean, myself, I think I was like, well, I can't afford to pay a band, so I'm going to go.
Right.
I'm going to just play by myself, and I better come up with something decent. But what was, can you talk a little bit about that band and then transfer, you know, transition?
Yeah, into, I mean, that band was like, I mean, I started playing music when I was 11. I started learning drums and guitar sort of at the same time and songwriting. My dad was a songwriter. And so I, you know, was wanting to do that. And my family, I'm an only child myself, but my family had a lot of cousins and uncles and stuff that were musicians. And so I did grow up around music. And so kind of got a, you know, got, that summer when I was 11 was when things really started going. And I would start playing in a band with my cousins.
Yeah.
Started playing with my cousins. And then that band, one of my cousins in particular, we like really had a good creative thing going. And that turned into the band that we would like, you know, move to New York City, get a, you know, record deal. And like, it was that band.
Yeah.
It,
yeah.
It developed into that.
Yeah.
And that was like a 10-year, you know, window basically.
That's and a pretty big window.
It's a pretty big window, yeah. You know, but it's, you know, coming out of my teens, you know, like right into that.
It was
you
a
know.
Young window.
It was, yeah. And anyway, I didn't, that all that stuff fell apart as they do. That label got bought and bands got dropped. And, you know, it was just one of those deals.
Yeah.
And we lived in different states. I stayed in New York and, you know, the rest of the band, everybody was in different places. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like in the beginning when we're two of us like sitting on a porch, you know, learning, playing songs or whatever.
And in the same world, in the same sphere, like that, you know, you're home. And then all of a sudden, yeah, you grow up and you kind of, you have to grow apart a little bit when you grow up. That makes having a band a little
But I was,
harder.
You know, focused on songwriting, you know, through all of that, you know, and so... So I just stayed with that, you know, and I just kind of did what I could on my own. I did put out like a, you know, like a before I started doing the one-man band thing with the banjo, I put out like a normal, you know, singer-songwriter album.
Okay. A normal
singer. You know what I mean? Like I played guitar, you know. It was like,
you sing about broken hearts.
Yeah. So that was my first one. That was like 1999. And then the next year is when I started doing the banjo stuff. And I did, I guess, 5 records like that. And then finally, Alpine Butterfly.
Yes.
That was kind of the one where I was like, you know what? I want to do some overdubs. I miss playing guitar. I miss playing drums, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I finally, you know, I kind of gave in and made like an overdub album.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
And let's, for those listening, you know, some, of course, a lot of people are familiar with the term overdub and what that means in the recording process. But like, for those that aren't as familiar, like overdubbing more versus just recording live with no additional tracks. You go in, you play it. What you play ends up on the record. But overdubs is when you get into, right, if you could just go into, like, how you would layer. Like,
right. And my whole life, musical life at that time, it was like, what if I couldn't do it live, it didn't happen, you know. So that's how everything was, is all just what I could do live. So it was a live performance and making the sound as full as possible.
Yeah.
With the drums and everything. But, and then I made three or four records like that. So you go into the studio, you get everything sounding right, and then you're just doing takes, you know.
And you just pick the three takes. And you pick your favorite one. You pick the favorite. That's the one. Yeah, that's the take.
Yeah, or it's not on the record, that kind of thing. And so getting into overdubs or layering is a luxury. It was felt like a whole new dimension. I was like, wait a second, you know.
Right. Where you could just play your vocals and acoustic one thing at a time, and then you could layer it, and then you could add another part on top of that, and layer and layer and layer, and you have all of these.
I mean, and I didn't want to stray too far away. You know, I wanted everything to, I want to be able to play the album live.
Yeah.
I just didn't record it all live, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if there is a
but I didn't go crazy with layering a whole bunch of stuff.
Where you couldn't reproduce it live. Exactly. Like, I feel like that is a thing. You know, you have this record that you love, and then you go see the act live, and you're like, I barely recognize it.
Yeah.
Right? So it's true. It's like when I go to see a band play and I love their record, I want there to be some kind of... I want to recognize it, or I want to be totally, I want it flipped on its, right? And them purposefully being like, oh, we are going to totally switch this around as a choice. Not as, right? Not as we can't, we did too much in the studio, we can't play it live.
Right.
I mean, it's all depend. You know, it's all good. But so speaking of which, I want to play. I want to play a song off the Alpine Butterfly.
Yeah. Well, what I was thinking just then, as you were saying that, is that it might be cool.
Yeah.
You know, to play one of the one man band songs.
Okay.
You know, and then so then it's kind of chronological.
Yes, we're gonna go like, chronological.
Here's what it was when
it was like
all
that.
Live.
Yes.
Know? And then we could play one that's, you know, with overdubs and stuff.
Yeah, so let's play the full raw. You get in there. It's
that
just
would be
you. And if
summon
it takes.
Song.
As some summon song.
And so, that is, I recorded that. Steve Albini was his producer. He just passed away recently, maybe a year or two ago. But he produced two of my albums. And this is one of them. And this was recorded at Electrical Audio, his studio in Chicago. And he was really known for just getting really great sounds.
Yeah.
Drums and just room sound. He produced In Utero.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That little record?
Drum sound, you know, was like that's what he was known for, that really great drum sound. So anyway. So
and your music, your earlier, and I think still, even on Alpine Butterfly, is so percussive, even if it's a little more minimal. It's still this drive. I love your I love the way you use percussion live and on Alpine Butterfly. It's so exciting to me. I rock out a lot to it in the car. So, all right, we are gonna play Summon Song.
All right, so this is like the full energy. You know, this is when I was. Literally a song I developed, you know, playing in Union Square.
Okay. So, all right.
Then, yeah.
So we are going to go for it.
sails will blow. And my shipping harbor sails, I'm gonna take on everyone, take on everyone. Throw 'em all up in my jail, all up in my jail. No, they won't see me coming till I'm right there in the way. They won't hear me coming, they won't even know my name.
Amazing.
Thanks.
And if you're just joining us, WGXC Acre 90.7, Radio for Open Ears on the Friday afternoon show with Philip Roebuck, just a fantastic musician. And if you get a chance to see him live, he is you live up here. You moved from the city and you live up here. But you were in Virginia, right?
Yeah. I lived in New York City 10 years. But I actually moved directly to Hudson from Virginia. Yeah. Okay. Moved back home to Virginia for a bit. So I've been here 4 years now.
Yeah, it flies by. I saw you 3 years ago at Hudson Roastery playing.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, what in the world? Philip Roebuck is playing in Hudson.
That is so wild to have that connection
I know.
With you from that far back.
I know.
It's another lifetime ago.
I know. Hmm. And, so please, if you have a chance, because he's playing around here, and you can they find that information on your Instagram or on your website?
No,
guys, you can't.
I'm at the level of like posters around town, and I
ooh,
hand
I
out
like
flyers.
It.
You know,
I like
that's
it.
That's just where I'm at with it.
And the venues, you know, say they post
that's
it. They
so
do,
helpful.
They
yes.
got to do that, right?
Yeah, I do lean on that.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. So then everybody, what you got to do is put Philip Roebuck in your Google search bar. and then it'll come up, whatever venue is because really, not to be missed, we saw him play at the Park Theater. I got to tell you, standing ovation. That was such a thrilling set. That was so awesome.
I think it's the most fun I've had playing up here. Just period. It was just really, I don't know. I felt sort of ready in a way that I hadn't been before. Like things were kind of coming together, you know, starting to, you know, but anyway, but also just the people that came out really made me, you know, felt supportive.
Yeah.
You know, and I was able to kind of use that, energy and turn that into some music, you know.
Yeah.
It's just a fun night.
Yeah. And the venue, the park, you know, Park Theater, Shannon, he's so supportive of the creative community.
Yeah.
And things that are going on there. And it's just such a treasure to have that space, to have
and
that.
And the sound is really good.
Oh my gosh.
Which is, you know, it's so important because you play better. Play better when it sounds good. People enjoy it, can appreciate it more. They can hear more details. Like there's so much to good live sound.
You
know, it's so valuable.
And I thought
really appreciate that.
Me too. And I think that whenever I'm there, I stop and I'm almost the sound here is incredible. And what's so amazing, even if there's like a theater piece where people aren't mic'd and they're not using the backline, it's got great acoustics, even without a mic. The voice carries in the room. It has this richness. It's the room. It's definitely what, you know, Brian did for sound and
yeah.
Right. Shabam, right. Our engineer, right. Who's a great engineer. It is wonderful. That was so fun. Also, you recently did a project which was also really exciting with the Hudson Festival Orchestra.
Oh,
so
yes.
Can you talk? Because you did that last year, and you did it this year as well. Can you talk a little bit about that project?
Yes. I hadn't. Okay, right. Okay, let's start here. It's a choir. Uh-huh. It's choir music that it's a small choir. Last year it was 8 people. This year it was 10 people, 10 voices. It's basically all voices and percussion. Mm-hmm. And it is very high energy and rhythmical. And it's actually a mantra choir. And it's different than other choir music in this way that it just loops. The different parts of the music are not divided so much in like soprano, alto, bass, tenor, you know, mm-hmm. these kind of groups. It's more just about the text. Like, okay, this group is singing this piece of text, mm-hmm. Which has a very, and it's these languages are like, it's mostly in Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. But there's also some Pali and some other languages, but they're all ancient mm-hmm. languages. And all of them also are metrical languages, like Sanskrit, Latin. They have, you know, the words, the actual words are basically eighth notes or quarter notes. It's mm-hmm. either a whole beat or half beat, mm-hmm. you know. And we're used to that, like iambic pentameter, you know, mm-hmm. pretty common English one, mm-hmm. is the same thing. We think of it as stress, like, you know, soft, hard, da, da, ba, ba. You know, mm-hmm. that's our iambs. Mm-hmm. Da, 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 da. And anyway, it's like that, but it's very musical. Mm-hmm. And those rhythms are very equal. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, the mantras wind up having a really strong rhythm of their own. Mm-hmm. And then when you layer them on top of each other, you get these instant polyrhythms. Mm-hmm. And also harmonies, and, you know, depending on what melodies you're singing, that's another dimension to it, is the melodic aspect. Mm-hmm. But I came into it just through the rhythmical aspect. Mm-hmm. And so we'd layer, on average, 4 at a time. And sometimes just the maximum will be 5. But anyway, it's a very exciting music to actually sing and do. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how it is as an audience member. Mm-hmm. I've only had 2 performances of it. Mm-hmm. We did get good responses, but I'm just going off of my own personal experience as a musician. I just find it really fun mm-hmm. to do that mm-hmm. music. It's, and mm-hmm. it's very different. It's not something mm-hmm. I have gotten to do before, but it's like, it's a lot like jamming with someone, mm-hmm. but you're just using these words. And mm-hmm. even though you're looping the same thing over and over, you can find nuances and swing mm-hmm. it different ways, mm-hmm. you know, within mm-hmm. within them and play.
Mm-hmm. But I think there is something to repetition, and I wonder sometimes, like, through a songwriter lens, you know, you sing a verse, and this one verse is about that, and then the second verse is new words, and it's about another aspect of the topic or heartbreak or whatever it is you're singing about, right?
Yeah.
And then you sing the chorus maybe 2-3 times, maybe 4 times, right? But there is something about repeating one thing or 2 things or 3 things over and over and over and over again that all of a sudden, in its seemingly sameness, and that seeming sameness, I think there is something that totally opens up in it. Mm-hmm. You mm-hmm. find newness in repetition that is really exciting.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because maybe, and it's maybe repeating that thing over and over again, you get it in your bones and in your under your skin, and you're not thinking anymore.
That is actually the whole point of it. That's, yes.
You
that's,
stop thinking and you just start feeling.
Yeah. And something about that, the repetition allows it to, I don't know, you can relax into it in a way. There's like a trust there. It's like, oh, it's going to come around again. It's going to come around again. You like get more and more relaxed each time. Not necessarily relaxed, but like more present. Like, okay, now what's going to happen this time around? You know?
Yeah. It's a really exciting way to listen. I think it sounds amazing. My friend Deb, who I just mentioned earlier, she watched the concert at the Hudson Festival Orchestra.
Oh, cool.
And she loved it. She also came to see you play as well. And said, don't get mad at me, Deb, I'm sharing this. she said, I had a hard time getting sleep because I was so buzzed because of the show. And she doesn't say, she's discerning, you know, she doesn't throw that around, those words around lightly.
Sure.
But I think that the Hudson Festival Orchestra, the crowd seemed to really respond.
Yeah.
I think.
Sure did.
Yeah. Right? So is that next year as well on the docket?
Think? I'm hoping to. I mean, I've had so many different visions of how this thing could have a life.
Evolve even, maybe?
What's that?
Evolve even, maybe getting used.
Yeah. Yeah, I've tried to figure out ways because it's pretty tricky. There's a bit of a learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually want it to be accessible to people. I want it to be a kind of music. It would be awesome to have it as a weekly thing.
Yeah.
Not so much a concert, but more like just a gathering to sing this stuff together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then once in a while, there could be a concert and we share it with more people. But
yeah.
So finding a home for it, little home base to kind of let people know about it and come and try it out.
Yeah.
That's the ideal for me.
Yeah,
not necessarily just concerts, but
a community gathering,
experiential thing.
Yeah. But also, what I thought was interesting too is that there is an element. I mean, you come from some punk influences, and I hear punk in your earlier stuff, definitely,
sure.
Which I love. And there is some of that, like, punkiness, I would say, even in the mantra choir. There's a little bit of drive. It's not, people might think, a mantra choir, you know, where we're sitting. No, it's got some, it's got some energy. It's got some edge, to it.
That's a good point. I think right out of the gate, hearing that phrase, you're thinking, like, sitting cross-legged on the floor.
Exactly. Burning sage.
Yeah. And just, being still or whatever. But this is actually, in my mind, everyone's moving.
Yeah. And super
dancing.
Active.
Dancing.
Yeah. I love it.
High energy.
Yeah. Very high energy. So on that note, let's play, I don't know, I'm torn because we have all my favorites. So some of my favorite songs here, Somebody Take Me Home.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
got some
I think
drive.
That'd be a good one. That's probably the most requested song from that album.
Okay.
So that might be a good one.
And so this is the post, and then we do have to get to the early days.
Right.
All right.
Well, this is okay. So we heard the like live in the studio one. This is like.
Oh more, yeah, we did. We okay. Yes, yeah. Yes. Right? Yes. We got the early
there.
Days. Yes.
And so this is like the layered one, but you'll see that it's still there's a live performance under it.
Yeah.
I did a live performance, and then I just added a few things. Anyway, okay. And one other thing I wanted to say: I've never been totally happy with this recording.
Really?
Yeah, because I originally wrote this song on the fiddle.
Uh-huh.
It was a fiddle tune for a long time. But I never really developed the fiddle as a live performance instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wound up doing it on banjo on this recording. And now I play it on my guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So I just miss the fiddle. So you kind of have to just have the spirit of the fiddle in there. I'm trying to do it with the banjo.
I think the spirit of the fiddle is there. But
okay.
It's also, remember, you know what it was. Everybody else just hears what it is.
I know. I probably didn't have to say anything. Also, now that I'm thinking of it, I'm like, well, why didn't I just put fiddle on top of it? I was
speaking of overdubs. Why didn't you just go to town
I was
on the overdub?
It was a very tricky time, because I was trying to, I was coming off this, just touring all the time. Everything was live.
Yeah.
And so it felt so indulgent to, so I tried to keep it as much as a live.
Yeah. I think that's a great, I would rather that than overindulge, personally. But that's maybe a personal opinion. All right, so all we're right. going to go for Somebody Take Me Home by Philip Roebuck. Very exciting. Okay, we are going to rock and roll. you're just joining us, that was Philip Roebuck, Somebody Take Me Home, off the Alpine Butterfly record, available on Spotify and Apple iTunes and all the places, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
We've been having a lovely conversation about very different musical periods, starting from one-man band in New York subways to, you know, more full records with some overdubs and layering for Alpine Butterfly. We do have No April Sun, another song I definitely want to play everybody before we say goodbye today.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one thing about that song was I started to play guitar again. Mm-hmm. That was the other thing that was new about this album. I had been on the banjo for 15 years, you know, and so it was, you know, it was kind of a big deal for me to be like, play guitar again on this, you know, on my recordings.
Can I ask you a question? Was there something, did you go through a period where you were just became really disinterested in playing the guitar? Like you started playing banjo and you just got your groove and that felt right at the time. But did that ever become a thing, like you kind of not shunned guitar, but it's just to the point where you like you really did not want to pick it up? I think that's interesting how people can sort of, musicians can kind of just really almost stop a relationship with a certain instrument for a period of time.
And that's exactly how it is. I mean, because I played drums and bass and guitar and fiddle and banjo and piano, you know. So there's, and there'll be times when there's a certain, only one of those instruments does the trick, you know, or that I feel like I'm, I don't know, it's like the right language for me at that, to express myself, you know, at that time. Mm-hmm. And that period can be either pretty short, short as a weekend, or, you know, a decade, you know.
Wow.
But it was, so trying to, I don't think it's a choice. It's not a, what do you call it? It's not like a...
A conscious decision.
Yeah. It's not like, I need to get my hour in on the, you know, I don't do it like that. You know? It just happens where it's just like, wow, I've been playing a lot of piano lately. What's going on with that? You know, or what, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. And so, so I wound up writing songs, you know, on the Alpine Butterfly on the guitar. There was something I was going to say about that was about the different instruments.
How you write inspires different writing, do you think, stylistically? Like more folk song on bed versus singer-songwritery stuff on the guitar. They kind of lend themselves...
Yeah. It's
By the way, I just have to say, I want everybody to know who was listening before we played that last song, that Phil was mimicking and miming playing the fiddle during that.
Right.
The lost fiddle, the fiddle that the ghost of the fiddle. But I heard the spirit of the fiddle in that recording.
Okay.
Even though it wasn't on it, I felt the spirit of the fiddle. So, it was there.
I did remember what I was going to say, by the way.
Okay.
Which was, this just happened to me, where...